Pandit Gopikrishna. If we accept the hypothesis that Kundalini is the psychophysiological mechanism that can lead to higher states of consciousness, how can a person go about preparing himself for the arousal or awakening of this power?
Kundalini is certainly the psychophysiological mechanism responsible for higher consciousness. But it is not a mechanism of the same kind as a computer is. This mechanism is operated by an energy which also operates our brain. It is known as prana in the Indian tradition. And this is the energy which science has still to know about. Our whole body is a machine. It is an organic machine from the brain to the toe of the feet. And this machine is manipulated by prana, or what we call bioenergy. This is a new form of energy in the universe, which is not perceptible to our senses. By no means whatsoever can science locate or know the nature of this energy with the methods it is using at present. The only way to locate and to know about this energy is by inner observation. It is in fact we as a whole which is behind the mechanism of Kundalini. Kundalini cannot be awakened by any force applied by a human being. It must awaken by itself. Even when we start the practices, it is by an impulse from within. All our thoughts, all our feelings come from the reservoir of mind. They are not our own. Mind is a stuff. It is not something fanciful or something about which there is no reservoir or a sort of a store in the universe. Mind is like matter, an element of creation. Unless we accept this fact, it is not possible to explain human intelligence or human mind. Mind is a stuff. And our fancies, our dreams, our thinking, our reasoning are made of this stuff. And this stuff is completely imperceptible to our senses. We only use a fragment of this mind stuff which surrounds us. A good part of it remains hidden behind the scenes, operating our body and acting to keep us alive with our day-to-day existence. We are not responsible for the body. We are not able to operate it. We are born alive, but when this power leaves us, we are dead. We are only a projection, a small projection of a great intelligence which animates our bodies. And that intelligence is prana shakti, the creative energy of the Absolute. We have to accept this first before we can understand Kundalini. In every human being, in every form of life, there is an intelligent energy about which we have no awareness, nor can we have any knowledge of it through our senses. It is an entirely different element of creation. I call it energy just figuratively. Otherwise, it is something which cannot be defined in our language. It is something totally foreign to us. It is this energy working in our body which gives us our life. And it is this energy which is responsible for the awakening of the Kundalini, for the activation of the Kundalini mechanism. When we start a practice, we feel an urge to do that. We feel an urge to know ourselves, to fathom the mystery of existence. Then we look around or read in books or hear from other people that there is such a mechanism as Kundalini in the body, and we start a practice. But all this is not our own. It comes from our interior depths. It comes from Kundalini itself. It is for this reason that in the Indian tradition, Kundalini has been treated as the architect or the master of the body. She is the queen of our body. She is the master of her body. We are but projections which she sends out as what they call in the Indian tradition, the jiva, the imprisoned fragment of the Absolute. We are an imprisoned ray of light from a divine sun. And this imprisoned ray of light is held a captive by this all-intelligent life energy which is known as Prana Shakti or Kundalini.
That is a very similar concept to the Egyptian idea of an imprisoned spark of life also. Yeah.
I think that all this philosophy of life has come from an anterior source which existed before the Egyptian or the Indian civilization. Anyway, that is a different topic. For the present, we are now concerned with this mechanism. We start a practice because it is the mechanism that has reached a stage where it needs our cooperation. For instance, a child of 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or even 10 years does not feel the reproductive urge, does not feel the sexual urge, and is not disturbed if there is a member of another sex to play with. But after the age, or even during the age of adolescence, both the sexes feel a very strong attraction for each other. Their behavior is now different than what it was before. They are not responsible for it. It is an inner development. For instance, if there were no inner development, no man would love a woman. This sex urge develops from within. In the same way, the urge to explore the mystery of self, to practice yoga, develops from within when a certain maturity of the nervous system and the brain is attained. Just as at the age of adolescence, a person likes to play with, to talk to sit together with a member of the opposite sex to whom it is attracted by an inner urge over which we have no control. Similarly, this desire to practice yoga, to worship, to pray comes from an inner urge over which too we have no control. In some people, this urge is present to a very strong degree. In others, it is lacking. The reason is, in some people, like some frigid women, this urge is not present. It is only when it is present it comes from our own interior. In fact, it too is a project of the same intelligence which rules us. And when this urge is present, in some it is present to a very overpowering degree, in others it is present to a very just negligible extent. It depends on the maturity and the condition of the cerebrospinal system. Those in whom it is present in an overpowering degree, they give up their home. Sometimes they give up their families and run after spiritual teachers and saints to learn the path to higher consciousness. In these cases, it is very powerfully active. In the same way as the sex instinct is very powerfully active in some people and to a less degree active in others. Now this urge to practice comes from Kundalini. Then we start the practice. Let us say we start the practice. In many people in whom this urge occurs, there also occurs a desire for self-perfection. They withdraw from the world. They want to do good actions. They want to do noble deeds. They want to be self-sacrificing. They feel more compassion for other human beings. These have been the characteristics of most of the mystics born in the world. So you can see a link, a physiological link in all what I say. Like the sex urge, this urge for transcendental experience comes up from our interior, and along with it also very often comes a desire for self-perfection and something of a withdrawal for the world. The reason is a mind devoted to higher consciousness must withdraw itself to some extent from the worldly struggle. This present civilization and all the amenities which science is providing us is also nature's effort to provide more leisure for man so that he is able to withdraw himself to some extent from the worldly struggle to devote his mind to reaching the higher state of consciousness. It is a means to an end, but we are treating it as an end to itself and using it for multiple comforts of our body. This all is interrelated. This human evolution, which is proceeding because of this psychosomatic mechanism, is proceeding further and further in science, philosophy, psychology, art, to make of us better men with more facilities and amenities, with also more knowledge of the nervous system and the brain, so that we may be able to devote more time to the search after God and to activate this mechanism in order to gain the state of consciousness which is destined for us.
Then there are specific practices, though, that can accelerate the process.
Now, this is another point. How has man progressed to this state of knowledge and culture? If we look very attentively how man has progressed so far, we will find that the only secret, the only method by which he has done so is mental application on a particular subject. People with an urge for the knowledge of stars used to gaze at the sky for hours. People with an urge for treating diseases used to devote their mind to the exploration of drugs and herbs and diseases of the body. It will be found universally that whatever knowledge man has gained has come through the application of his mind and intellect through study and concentration. Then concentration is the natural method for reaching higher knowledge, for gaining knowledge and experience of the world. The same concentration is necessary for also reaching the higher states of consciousness. All the practices for attainment of higher consciousness have meditation as a cardinal exercise. It is because concentration is the natural method for the evolution of the brain. So the practices, whatever they are use of our mind for deep study, meditation and contemplation. When we apply this mind to worldly objects, we get the knowledge of science and arts. Apply this mind to divine things or on our own self or Atman, we get knowledge of the higher consciousness. The method is the same, the mechanism is the same. You will find that in every religious practice, from the time of the shamans to this day, concentration, application of the mind has been the main instrument for reaching this state. Since there has been a systematic search in the past, and many, many people, hundreds of thousands, millions have devoted their lives to gaining knowledge of the self, they have also devised techniques to help concentration, such as breathing exercises, such as fixing the eyes on some object, such as telling the beads, reciting the mantras. They are all aids to meditation. But meditation is the chief instrument responsible for reaching higher states of consciousness, as application of the mind on worldly things has been responsible for reaching the present state of civilization and also for gaining all the knowledge of science and arts.
So the word meditation is really a synonym for concentration.
Definitely for applying the mind on one subject.
Yes.
You can't allow the mind to roam, that will be drowsing. In every book on the subject, whether it is Chinese meditation or it is Indian meditation, you will find stress on concentration, on one pointedness of the mind, on directing the mind on one object to the exclusion of others. It is by this practice, continued for a long time, that you gain mastery over the center in the brain where the willpower, where the will of a human being to concentrate is centered. Then you are able to concentrate for longer periods of time. Ultimately, what happens is that with prolonged concentration, a certain region in the brain wakes up. That is the awakening of Kundalini. Along with the awakening of that center in the brain, a new form of energy starts to pour into our head, coming from the reproductive essences, transformed into what is known as ojas, which flood the brain, and a new consciousness results. This new consciousness is not something imaginary. It has a concrete reality.
So there are two centers that open. There's a center in the brain that actually opens.
It opens, yes.
And then simultaneously, a center at the base of the spine must open in order to...
It starts to work. It starts to operate to send up a new form of energy. If the two did not start simultaneously, if a new form of energy did not irrigate the brain, it will result in insanity.
Then what actually flows up through the spinal canal?
It is the reproductive energy transformed into radiation. It has two aspects. One, a subtle essence which pours actually into the brain. And in the tantric literature or even other books on yoga is known as the dripping of the nectar. You will find invariably this mentioned in the books. And if you look at the picture of Shiva, the traditional picture of Shiva, you will find that from his hairy head, which is surrounded by a cobra, by a snake, a stream of water is pouring out, which is known as the Ganges. This is the stream of nectar which flows into the brain on the awakening of the Kundalini.
Yes, I have seen that picture.
It is this stream of nectar which helps the neurons to develop. Otherwise, if it didn't drip and the center were to open, it would lead invariably to mental disorder.
Now, many scientists have taken this to be simply a symbolic concept, having no reality in the physical counterpart in the body. But you believe it's physical as well as subjective.
I am talking of a thing which has a tradition extending to 5,000 years, corroborated by hundreds of thousand yogis and recorded also in thousands of books in India. I am not concerned with what the scientists say, because at this moment they have no knowledge about the activity of the nerves or what energy fuels the brain. They are completely lacking in real knowledge about the brain and the nervous system. The time is near now when they will have to accept the position about which I am talking at the moment.
So then, if they do accept the position, it will have to be empirically verifiable.
They will have to accept it, because the experiments which I am proposing will ultimately show that what I say is correct. That under certain conditions, a dormant center in the brain can leap to activity. They have already the evidence in the case of geniuses and in the case of the mediums. Also in the case of certain categories of the mentally afflicted. Since they have not yet developed their instrumentation to record the subtle energies working in the body, they are not able to locate the mechanisms which I am describing. The time is near now. It won't take them long to reach a state where they can see the operation of the energy about which I am.
These practices that can force the awakening more or less, will they always work, or does it depend on every individual?
This mechanism is operating in every human being in a very extremely slow manner. By practicing these techniques, we accelerate the mechanism. Whether we will succeed in opening the center or in sending up the stream of energy does not depend on us alone, but on this energy also. That is the reason why, according to the Indian tradition, grace is always necessary before one can attain to higher state of consciousness. Here, we have no knowledge of what laws come into operation when a man reaches the threshold of higher consciousness. This is a new world, a new element of creation, a new universe, and it will take ages before man is aware of the laws that rule it. It is not such a simple affair like switching on a light. We are here dealing with the energy that rules the universe.
In some of your past writings, you have laid great stress on hereditary factors.
It is evolution. The genes are necessary. You see, here now, nature has ordained that the parents should live exemplary lives to have a progeny which is able to reach to higher states of consciousness, not only themselves, but also the constitutions of the husband and the wife should correspond so that the product is healthy in body and mind to withstand the pressure and the stress that always occurs when the mechanism is accelerated.
If Kundalini is then a science, by this I mean that the methods lead to an awakening, is it still possible for a person who has led an immoral life or who has few moral qualities to awaken this power?
Kundalini is not a science in the existing sense of sciences. It is a super science. It is a science of the soul. What the science which we know at present is science of matter. Kundalini is the science of the soul. What I say can be empirically verified. You see, one method is that the scientist should experiment on himself. I am sure that any intelligent scientist with a healthy body and mind and a sound heredity, if he practices the disciplines for a sufficiently long time and leads a life needed, he will certainly be able to experience, if not entirely what I say, but part of it. Some scientists do. In fact, one or two very eminent scientists, one of them a Nobel Prize winner, have acknowledged it in my presence. They do, only they do not express what they experience for fear of ridicule of their contemporaries and colleagues. This question seems to me the offspring of the general impression prevailing that man has reached the highest state of his existence and that intellect is all that is needed to live on the earth. This is not a correct attitude of the mind. All religious revelation lays stress on cardinal virtues, on morality, on nobility of character, on truthfulness, on compassion, on non-violence, on fellow feeling and neighborly love. Why? All these qualities do not fit in with the scientific concept of a struggle for existence. In fact, disregard for others' feelings, even cruelty, as we see in the animals. A whale must have tons of small fish as her food every day. But when we come to man, we see the beginning of a conscience or a moral sense. Whatever the reason, man believes in neighborly love, in truth, in honesty, in compassion, whether it is due to religious teaching or social pressures or man's own instinctive development, the fact remains that humanity as a whole believes in the cardinal virtues in human character. All our jurisprudence and all our ideologies are based on this fact. Why is it? It is because man is reaching towards a consciousness, reaching towards a state of mind where above everything he needs peace, tranquility and security. Aggression and violence always lead to distraction and disturbance of the mind. But what man needs in the consciousness towards which he is striving is security, harmony and peace. This security, this harmony and this peace cannot be had unless our behavior is such that violence, aggression hate and malice are avoided. Therefore, for his own safety and for his own progress, it is absolutely necessary for the human race to have certain moral attributes which can give it the type of life that it needs. You cannot have peace and aggression, violence and tranquility at the same time. And these are absolutely necessary for man to reach or to explore the subtler stratas of creation. You can only look to the bottom of a pool when the surface is unruffled. If the surface is ruffled, you can never look to the depths or to the placid waters at the bottom of that lake or pool. Similarly, you can never explore consciousness unless the mind is calm, unless the upper layer allows you to look deep inside. For this purpose, it is essential that man should live a moral life. For this purpose, there is a barrier imposed by nature. For anyone who does not lead a moral life, forbidding him from proceeding further. If he forces his way, the result is what we see in thousands of lunatic asylums on the earth.
So then this barrier that prevents anyone from actually successfully awakening Kundalini.
It doesn't only hinder the awakening of Kundalini, but it will make human life impossible. The more our intelligence grows, the more should human life, individually or collectively, be ruled by moral laws. If he doesn't, man will annihilate himself. Imagine immoral people coming into power in every country in the world with nuclear arms in their hands. Do you see any way of escaping annihilation? It is obligatory, it is absolutely imperative for human beings to become more and more moral as we progress in our intellectual achievements. Slowly we are gaining control over the most terrible forces of nature, and in the hands of a lustful man who has no self-discipline, humanity will always remain in danger of her life. You cannot combine an immoral humanity with the power she has gained over the forces of nature even up to this time. If she gains now control over even the psychic forces, the subtle forces of nature, then her moral advancement becomes imperative. She would not be able to survive. Therefore, it doesn't rest with you or me whether we should be moral or should not be moral. It is an imperative which we have to obey.
Then you've already answered this question, but is enlightenment a mere mental or physical phenomenon independent of right and wrong?
It is not possible to transcend the human state of awareness unless man is morally advanced than the animal. It will be to his own destruction if he attains to the state of enlightenment without being able to curb his own passions, ambitions, greed and desire. If he now reaches a higher dimension of consciousness, which involves his entry to subtler planes of creation, these human passions and ambitions and greed can create a storm, a havoc in his interior when he is floating in the void of higher consciousness, and that can do immense damage to his whole body. I virtually escaped death a dozen times, because by the grace of heaven, I had started to discipline myself from the age of 17 and had acquired not absolute, but a certain measure of control over my urges, appetites, likes and dislikes. If I had not done so, I could never have survived the art.
So this relates back to what you said earlier about mental patients in our institutions being a product of Kundalini having gone wrong.
Kundalini as a somatic mechanism can also function in a manner that impure radiation goes to the brain, with the result that the neurons are damaged and there is mental disorder results from that. The other thing is that the man is himself impure. The Kundalini goes to the brain, needs a disciplined individual now, but the man is prone to his passions and desires and then succumbs to some temptation and is lost.
Could you elaborate on these temptations? I mean, are you talking strictly about overindulgence in sex? Or
what I mean is, should be understood in this sense, that what you think, what scientists think, what physicians think, a normal, moderate way of life also suited for the awakening of Kundalini. Man is a man, he is not an animal. He knows that too much of indulgence will weaken his body. Too much of eating will spoil his stomach. Too much of drinking will ruin his liver. He knows all this, and this is confirmed by physicians and those who are studying man from this angle of view. Therefore, it is imperative that man should live a healthy and moderate life to be able to ascend to the higher dimension of consciousness. I don't say that he should be perfect. I say he should live a reasonably moderate life. I have also done the same. I am not an angel or a saint. I have lived a moderately normal life and I have succeeded. Nature doesn't demand of man what is impossible, but what is possible and within his own control. But he doesn't do it. He is drowned in pleasure. He wastes his time. He sleeps at irregular hours. He eats unhealthy food. He works like a machine. That means he doesn't lead a moderate life, as has been stressed by every prophet and every religious creed. I say that if he leads a moderately balanced life, that is sufficient for his progress on the spiritual path. There is no need for him for austerity or penance or self-mortification or fasting or giving up any pleasure of the earth. What I say is that he should avoid the extremes.
Would a leap in consciousness lead man to conduct his everyday life in a kinder, more enlightened way, or is it a one-time flash giving a momentary cosmic vision but leaving human emotions and conduct untouched?
It can be both a one-time flash and also a perennial form of his life. He can be in a higher consciousness day and night for years till death, or have it occasionally as a flash. The latter is very difficult because it puts a tremendous stress on the body. But to have occasional flashes does not put such a stress. The body then comes back to the normal and at occasions goes into higher states. But in either case, a regulated and balanced life is necessary. Also a life which is not selfish, which is not greedy, which is not overambitious, which has the good of others too at heart. I mean a life as advocated by the great prophets of mankind without taking it to the extreme. Just moderately balanced, honest and true life.
If a person who is either practicing yoga or not happens to have a momentary flash of illumination, does that leave him or her permanently changed?
It should. The experience is so staggering that it should. But then it should be the generous flash, not just something imaginary or forceful or like a drug experience or a visionary experience induced by passive types of meditation. It should be a genuine mystical experience. Then it leaves a permanent one.
Well, here we come to a very controversial subject.
Yeah.
Because what is genuine, each person has been led to believe, is very subjective. They say that what you might say is genuine may be genuine for you, but what I might experience would be genuine for me, even though they're not the same. But you claim this is not a subjective experience, that it can be objectively verified.
You see, now we know, for instance, we can speculate at what should be the mental condition of apes. There is something common in all the apes and their mind, common instincts, common ways of behavior, common sex activity and the like. Similarly, we have also a uniformity at the level of human consciousness. The behavior is similar, thinking is similar. It may be differing on various aspects, but there is something underlying homogeneity in human consciousness. Can we suppose that in the higher consciousness there is utter confusion and every can have whatever he thinks is mystical experience? There must be some underlying uniformity there also. And for that purpose, we have just to read and study what was the experience of genuine mystics all over the earth. There are thousands of books recording the experiences of these mystics. The earliest are the Upanishads. They all can provide us with a model of what a mystical experience actually is.
Still, here again, there are many, many books by those who claim to be genuine mystics that do vary considerably. So, again, we have to try to understand what is the truly genuine, even in the traditions, because there are yogic traditions that do vary considerably from those mentioned in the Upanishads, for example.
Definite similarities between the true mystical experience. Only an exhaustive study is necessary. Generally, people don't study the mystical literature. What they read are books by modern writers who never had the experience themselves. There are many ways by which we can distinguish. One of the ways is that the person who has the experience should write it down in his own words. There are many accounts written by modern who think they had the experience. But to a discerning eye, you can at once detect the false from the true. Generally, one who has a mystical experience and has entered the other world for even a few minutes must be able to write the experience in an original way, which is very difficult.
In an original way?
Yeah.
Do you mean in an original language?
I mean in a way which is striking, which carries conviction. Otherwise, there is rhetoric and there is a lot of superfluous matter which does not appeal to a human being, as does the few words of a real mystic.
It is a common saying that that the genuine mystical experience cannot be described.
It cannot be described, but it can be described by similes and metaphors and by other means. You cannot describe human consciousness to an ape. It will be a waste of time. But you can, by certain metaphors and signs, you can show him where he is lacking. It can be done, not completely, but to a reasonable extent. For instance, in the Upanishads, they say neti about this experience. Neti. Not this. Neti. Not this. Neti. Not this. Whatever you describe is not this experience. This is a very famous phrase in the Upanishad. Neti, 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 neti. Not this, not this, not this, not this. One of the characteristics of the genuine mystical experience is it resembles nothing of it.
Now, I know you've described your experiences in a number of passages.
It can be compared to nothing. And also the man who has the experience, as Ramakrishna has said, exudes a fragrance. We know he has reached to the higher. His behavior is balanced. He is moderate. He is wise. He is intelligent. He is sober. Where you don't see these characteristics, you should see this an imitation, that it is just a fancy, but not the real thing.
In the common sense of the word, it is not a vision.
It is not a vision. The higher consciousness is not a vision. It is a state of being. You see, that is the difference. It is a state of being. I am this now. I don't see anything external to myself. I see myself transformed in the higher consciousness. It is a vision of myself.
That is what, yeah, for the average person to comprehend.
It is. It is. If I were to say something which an ordinary person can at once imagine, I would be failing in my duty.
Because I've read in a number of instances where other so-called mystics have claimed that you have not reached the highest state, but that you have just reached a sort of an elevated state.
For instance, let us take this Huxley description of higher consciousness. It is more or less a drug experience or a diluted experience. What he says as the antibodies of the mind and strange beings, and there's nothing of this. There is clarity, lucidity. In the mystical state, the clarity and the lucidity is 100 times more than in normal context. The intellect is fully awake, fully, and watching the difference. I was this, at this time I am this. It is not like a dream or a drug experience.
But sometimes it is a trance state.
Even when it is a trance, the person is awake. The trance is for the body. The inner soul, the soul is more awake. You should read. That is why I say that people do not read. You see, the original statements of the real mystics, what they are reading are the versions of modern writers which can never understand the experience. In every genuine mystical experience, the person is more clear and lucid in his mind than he was in the normal state of consciousness. There is no transition. You see, when you go from normal consciousness to sleep, there is a transition. You forget what you were, and somebody else is now looking at dream. Similarly, in the case of drugs, you have a transition. You were a normal human being. Now you have a different vision of lights and sounds or bizarre experiences. It is not in the case of mystery. It is just you walk straight into another world with all your faculties, of course, insensitive to this world or the moment, but with your inner faculties all alert.
But still, no vision.
You see, there are now two kinds of experience depending on the constitution of the person. There may be, one may see a Christ, one may see Vishnu, one may see Shiva, one may see Buddha. But with that vision before the mind, person's own self and that vision also, they don't appear in the normal light as we see them in our everyday consciousness, but magnified, expanded, belonging to another dimension of consciousness, not to this.
You've also claimed that this experience leads one to genius.
It could be, for instance, take the case of the greatest musicians and the greatest painters. The greatest musicians have an awareness of those subtle melodies and notes which are not very easily perceptible to normal human beings. Similarly, the great painters have a sense of colors and their harmony, sense of symmetry, sense of natural grandeur, which the common people miss. That means they have become more sensitive to sound and to sight, which is a characteristic of higher consciousness.
But in your case, you've undergone a complete change.
It took me years to reach those subtle changes in my perception. It didn't happen in one day. I only saw an expanded field of vision. And I also saw that whatever object I saw had a sort of a white coat over it, like a white dust, like a chalk dust. Slowly, this chalk dust was transformed into a silvery sheen. And every color, every picture now appears to me so fascinating that I would like to go on looking at the sky for hours.
Now than it was.
Yeah, intellectual, mental, aesthetic, moral, every transformation. And I am still being transformed. Even now, this process is going on.
Do you talk about illumination and the important role played by the founders of faiths and other spiritual luminaries from personal experience? If so, can you describe your own experiences?
Yes, I am speaking on the subject from personal experience. This experience first started in my 34th year and has continued since then to this day. It will be a long story covering several volumes, but I would just mention a few facts which would show what characteristics are present in a genuine mystical experience. There have been several peculiarities in my transformation which need mention. One of these peculiarities has a special significance in relation to the traditional views about cosmic consciousness. As stated in my autobiography, my experience started with the flow of a luminous ether into my brain. The first impact of this radiation was unforgettable. It seemed as if a lustrous spray arising through the spine was swirling into my head like an extremely fine luminous current of molten silver in an unending stream which illuminated the whole interior of my brain. This inner luminosity never ceased and has continued with increasing intensity and volume to this day. I cannot express in words the wonder of this experience. I always am in an ocean of light. When I look outside on the world, I find everything illuminated by a silvery light, as if the whole of the universe is bathed in brilliant moonlight, with this difference that this light is not insentient but living and conscious. To me it seems as if there is a luminous ocean of consciousness surrounding me, in which I am like a small piece of wood floating on the surface of an ocean. I attach the greatest significance to this part of my experience. It is in this aspect of my experience that I differ radically from the cases of conversion or inner transformation described in the books on the subject written in our time. Whenever I turn my attention upon myself, I invariably find myself floating in an ocean of life, a tiny speck of ego surrounded by a lustrous ocean of awareness spread unbounded in extent, inscrutable and unfathomable to the intellect, and yet, for all its infinity and majesty, my own frail, humble self, at the same time, a pygmy and a cosmic conscious colossus at the same time. While in bed at night, I close my eyes preparatory to sleep. I see wave after wave of the luminous vapor rising into my head, making me feel as if I am floating on a sea of luminous clouds stretching on every side as far as I can perceive. It is in the background of this darkly resplendent immensity that I let my mind wander from one thought to the other, as normally happens before the oblivion of sleep overtakes us. The only difference is that the thoughts I think and the images I evoke are also luminous, wrought of the same radiant stuff which now forms the fabric of my mind. A drastic change has occurred in the mind stuff which animates me and which I call as my own self. It is no longer colorless or dark or without any features, but resplendent and radiant to a high degree. The mechanism of thought which I possessed before the awakening is still vividly before my eyes. It was then a normal apparatus, and I thought or imagined as other human beings do. But now I have a moon-like cool luster always shining in my interior day and night, bathing all my thoughts, fancies, reveries and dreams in light, making the whole panorama of interior alluring and fascinating to a degree which is impossible to describe. My inner being is not the same as it was in my childhood and youth, but has been transformed by imperceptible degrees into an Eden of life, light and beauty not possible for a normal mind even to conceive. What I wish to make clear, with all the emphasis at my command, is that this splendorous inner state, this luminous pattern of mind, is not the product of magic, nor a miraculous gift won by divine favor, but the direct outcome of a biological transformation of my body. It is by a constant process of transmutation, which started in my mortal frame on the arousal of Kundalini 45 years ago, that a new resplendent form of consciousness has developed in me, and that I now live, think, and dream in this state of consciousness as normal human beings do in theirs. I am sure of the authenticity of my conclusions as I am of my life. I am also equally sure that this organic transformation of the human body leading to this luminous state of consciousness can be demonstrated in a laboratory with the methods of science. Light has been a constant feature of illumination. In the stories of mystics, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Upanishads, in the self-revelations of mystics, as for instance, Rumi, Abhinavagupta, Lal, Kabir, Saint Francis, and others, there is always mention of light or glory surrounding the visions which they had. This means that light is an invariable feature of higher consciousness. I cannot say how it happened, nor what factors came into play, nor what grace descended on me, but the fact remains that I live, eat, sleep, talk, and work in a state of illumination which is always present in my interior. Is self-luminous. It is shining. I see it traversing my nerves, going into my brain, doing everything in my body.
So you are living in this state 24 hours?
24 hours. There is no diminution except in illness. But then it is there. Only it is now in a state of, I should say, disturbance. But still, most of the time, my calmness, my inner happiness continue. So long as the illness is there, I am not so alert. In fact, my illness starts first from the mind. I become aware that the body will be indisposed.
Why is there so much resistance to the idea that the brain is still evolving?
You see, acceptance of this idea would place science in a quandary. Now, if the brain is evolving, where? What mechanism is responsible for it? Then secondly, if it is evolving in a certain predetermined direction, it means that evolution is planned. That will create confusion in the present materialistic or mechanistic concepts of modern science. It will be a very terrible day when the experiments done on Kundalini are proved.
Will they be accepted?
How can they be ignored? You see, we will invite now applications also from people who have awakened. There will be hundreds of thousands all over the world. Then the experiment. If we had the resources, I think in 10 years we could create a climate by our research and study, also by experiments, which would force science to accept us. And then even scientists can proceed with this investigation. Not only once, but maybe for centuries to come. And the experiments will confirm each other. What alternative will then they have? You can see it is a consistent explanation of everything that you see. Of war, of peace, of future, of one world. Which even the people are now beginning to realize. Many people now wish that there were a one world government. That there were no wars. That people were allowed to live in peace. That the old standards are wrong. That values should be changed. Isn't it like that? Why? Because this is the instinctive urge in many minds. And this corresponds to what I say. The evidence for what I say is in the civilizations of the past, in the rise and fall of dynasties, rich families, in the appearance of prophets and enlightened beings, in the appearance of geniuses from time to time, in every subject, every branch of knowledge, to help mankind to go ahead. Otherwise, there is no reason why there should be a genius, and that genius should be so eager to give something new to the earth. It is because of this urge of evolution. There is also no reason why a large percentage of mad people should be megalomaniacs or claim to be great poets, great philosophers, great heroes, great conquerors, great prophets. It is because Kundalini is morbidly awake and they have that evolved mind but disoriented. You will find consistently in what I say, it is only blind prejudice that is preventing scholars from accepting and experimenting on it. This is the frontier of knowledge which science must reach if mankind is to survive. And it will be reached. Not only that, maybe either someone in a lunatic asylum, or some scientist, or some great man in power, may suddenly be confronted by an awakened Kundalini, either in himself or in his own offsprings. That will focus attention on the phenomena. Let what I say be recorded. That should be your effort. Let nothing escape. Let it be put in black and white, in tapes, in books. Don't worry about it. It is not a bestseller. Let it be accumulated. Let it be put in a printed form somewhere. Only even a few hundred copies, a few thousand copies. The time will come when every line will be read and devoured even by people in search of this law. Just I should have time, by the grace of heaven, to put on record all that I have to say. Beg of heaven to give you enough to eat, dress and maintain yourself. Don't worry about the message. It has been sent out. Enough. You may be sure it will be accepted, it will provide guidance for the future, and maybe for hundreds, even thousands of years. Because it is by an unusual combination of circumstances that I have surprised. Give you a peaceful time so that you may devote every ounce of your energy to this task of, so far as possible, publicizing, recording and accumulating this knowledge. Only beg of heaven on your knees to grant health and some years of life us, so that we may be able to place as much of this knowledge on record as is possible. There is much to be said on politics, on science, on economics, on everything under the sun, on brain, on the human body, everything. In future, there will be people who will have the same awakening. They will like to have every bit of information to save themselves. It is a terrible power. It is not just what these people claim. It is a leap from one dimension of consciousness into another, from one world into the other. It's not a small matter. But somehow, by the grace of heaven, I have survived the ordeal and I'm here talking to you. So be relaxed and calm. We have already covered a long way. How do I say that? Because this term Kundalini has become a talking point. This discovery, this rediscovery, will win through. It has come at the most critical time in the history of mankind. There must be a reason for it. Mankind has to survive for hundreds of thousands, even millions of years. Can you imagine this state of suspense, these stockpiles of nuclear weapons, this enmity between nations for even five centuries, and scholars flooding the market with novels and other sensational works, even for 200 years? Can we imagine this continuance of the present order, even for 100 years? Then what have you the substitute? Have you any plan for the future, except the repetition of the same thing over and over again? This is the plan which befits man, which befits his intelligence. There will be men. Now we call them intellectuals, we call them geniuses. In future, we will call them the Illuminati, the Enlightened. You can class them with Christ, Buddha, and other great luminaries. Now they will be cultivated. They were born in the past, but now with knowledge of this mechanism, the state can be voluntarily cultivated, of course, always with the grace of the divine power. A new philosophy will come out, a new way of life, a new political system, a new social order will all emerge out of this experiment in course of time. To curtail their passions, their ambitions and their desires, the incentive offered will be much greater than what they can achieve if they gain wealth or power or position or rulership. That would be cheap and trite in comparison to the mental grandeur and the glory of higher consciousness. Every great mystic showed indifference towards the world, towards its wealth, towards its pleasures, towards its happiness, because the treasure that they found inside was much more valuable and precious than what they could achieve on the earth. When this path is opened and confirmed, people will discipline themselves. The leaders, the scholars, and the scientists will all try to reach the same state of transcendence, which is the target of evolution. That would provide a healthy exercise for their intellects and for their efforts, so that better governments, a more Catholic science, and a broader religion will take the place of the present ways of government, the present science, and the present churches. When this happens, war will automatically be eliminated.